Good evening. It's good to be with you this evening. As I guess a brief introduction there, I'm from Living Water in Reinholds, about an hour and a half south of here, pretty much. So my wife and four girls stay at home. They like to get perfect attendance if possible at Lichty, so they usually stay home when I make these rounds on the circuit here. So it's good to be with you. This is the first time I've been here, so I've seen pictures of the church in the newsletters and different things, but I've never actually been inside here or quite pictured where the building was. So I'm glad to be here this evening and get a little bit more of a feel for where you're at here, and been through the town different times, but never much off the main drag through here. So this evening our topic is an interesting topic, humility in a selfie world. And I think the title itself is a good title. Somebody on the Winder Bible School committee must have put a little time into that, because it kind of has a double meaning as we think about the title, Humility in a Selfie World. And there's a lot of different ways, different things that we could look at in this, but if you turn to 2 Timothy 3, and you can turn there if you want to, but I'm just going to read over that list that it says there. It says it, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come." And in the, it lists them in the King James Version. I'm going to read it out of the NIV. "But mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. Have nothing to do with such people." And that's quite a list there. And it's interesting that the first item on the list is people will be lovers of their own selves, or lovers of themselves. And as we're looking at the subject this evening, we know that a selfie, we all know what that is. I don't think I have to go into any explanation of what a selfie is, but 20 years ago, I guess people wouldn't have really used the word selfie. But of course, with the smartphone, that became a thing where people take pictures of themselves with their phones on the front-facing camera. And that's become a big thing, to see people, you know, at different places taking a picture of themselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's something technology gave us. But it is maybe a little bit of a symptom of something that goes on with people becoming kind of self-absorbed. And social media and the technology has certainly probably made that worse in a lot of different ways. But while that is a modern invention, the selfie, the problem of self and people battling self is not a new thing by any means. The struggle between self and humility has been something that Christians have battled with as long as God's people have been on earth. And we call a person who is self-absorbed a narcissist. That's a word that comes from Greek mythology, and it comes from the myth of Narcissus, who was a hunter in Greek mythology, and he was very enamored with his own good looks. He was known for how handsome he was, and because of that, he didn't think that anybody was good enough to be a partner with him, because he was kind of so much in love with himself. And so one of the gods cursed him by making him look into a pool of water and see his reflection. And when he saw his reflection, he was so amazed by how good-looking he was that he couldn't look away, and he was stuck there in the pool throughout what the story goes for however long, trapped, because he couldn't get away from his own reflection. And so that's where the word narcissist comes from. And we use that word to describe somebody who is, the symptoms of that are being overly boastful, exaggerating one's own achievements, pretending to be superior to others, lack of empathy for others, looking down on others as inferior, monopolizing conversations, impatient, angry, unhappy, depressed, or has mood swings when criticized, and has a very fragile self-esteem. And I don't know if you know people that have some of those symptoms. There are certainly, we all have some of those symptoms, I'm sure, some of those problems that we all struggle with to a certain level, but it seems like there's a certain personality type that really struggles with a lot of those things, and through Christ type we can overcome those problems. But certainly narcissism and the problem of being self-absorbed is something that is very real today, and has been throughout for mankind ever since creation. The book of Proverbs is, of course, was written long before the selfie came about, but it's just as relevant today as it was back then. And there's so many verses in Proverbs that talk about the problem of self and of humility and compares the two. Also talks a lot about the fool, and often those symptoms that we looked at there of the narcissist could very well describe how Proverbs describes the fool. The first chapter in Proverbs, and you can turn there if you want to, if you have your Bibles, Proverbs 1. You might already know these verses, but let's just read the first 7 verses there. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instructions, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, and judgment, and equity, to give subtlety to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels. To understand a proverb and the interpretation, the words of the wise and their dark sayings. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. I think we can see in those first 7 verses there in Proverbs kind of maybe a good summary of what Proverbs is about for the rest of the book as well. But you can see that there's several things in there that humility requires. And if I was listing them out, I would probably say those things are humility or honesty, wisdom, a teachable spirit, and perception, or somebody that perceives things and is wise, able to see through things that are not true. And we know that there isn't a separate set of rules for how we live online and how we live our real lives. And so if we're supposed to be people of humility, which we are, and not narcissists, we need to make sure that our whole life is filled with a spirit of humility. And we can't say that humility is a virtue in real life and then go online or go behind somebody's back and act differently about it. And one thing I do want to say about this subject is that probably most of you are not heavy users of social media. I think when I talk to most churches in Winter Bible School in Keystone, probably there's very few or very much minority that are actually heavily using social media. So we kind of probably all have an idea more of how what we see on social media and what we kind of see as a problem. But I want us to realize that even if we're not using social media, try to apply this to your own life and in your conversation and in the way that you practice your life. These are things that I think affect each one of us, even if we're not really big into our Facebook and Instagram accounts and things like that. So I'd like to look at this evening at a couple of different aspects of humility. And I'd like to start by looking at humility in living and how we live our lives. And this is maybe where we'll look the most at social media as a problem, where people tend to, maybe the first two symptoms of being a narcissist, they're being overly boastful, exaggerating of one's achievements, and pretending to be superior to others. This is where these things often come out in people's social media posts. And we, as Christians, as people of humility, should be people that are willing to admit our weaknesses, people that don't try to put on a front and look like we're something that we're not. And that's a big problem that social media has really, I think, amplified, is the image crafting that's possible online, where people can, by selectively putting pictures and posts and linking articles, they can make themselves appear a certain way and make their lives look like everything is going great, when often that's really not what's happening in real life or what's happening in their own personal lives. And so you probably all have had the experience of seeing somebody that looked like they had a perfect life online. You know, they had great vacations. They were always talking about how much they loved each other as a husband and wife and things like that. And then all of a sudden you find out that they're getting divorced. And it looks like, well, they were living the perfect life according to their Facebook account and their Instagram. But as we all know, that's not often what's really going on behind the scenes. And a lot of social media posts are things talking about things like how good I look, look at my cool stuff, the things that I have. I have the best of whatever, the spouse, a job, a boss, a family. And it can be very obsessed with creating an image of ourselves that often is kind of based on dishonesty and pride at the root of it. In Proverbs, if we go to the back of the book of Proverbs here, Proverbs 30, there's a section there that's a chapter in chapter 30 that's written by a man named Agar. At the top of that, it says observations, chapter 30 at the top there says observations of Agar. And in those verses 7 to 9, I think is what we want to look at there, he says, two things have I required of thee, deny me them not before I die. Remove far from me vanity and lies, give me neither poverty nor riches, feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord, or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of the Lord my God in vain. So what's happening here is Agar is asking God for two things. And if you had to ask for two things from God and God said you can have two things, just ask me what you want, what would you ask for those two things? We would all be tempted to probably ask for things like more opportunities, more travel opportunities, more popularity, more riches. And that's probably what we would be tempted to ask for. But hopefully we would make different decisions than that about what we would ask God for. But what Agar asks here is for basically two things. And they're probably not the two things that would come to my mind first when I would think of two things that you would ask God. But he said, don't deny me. He said, deny me not before I die. Remove far from me vanity and lies. In other words, honesty. Keep falsehood and lies far away from me. And so this was his first request. And he said he wants a life that's honest or real before God. And he asked God to keep him from getting caught kind of in a web of deceit. And then his second request there is basically that he's neither rich nor poor, that he's somewhere in between. And again, that's asking God for a life of simplicity and contentment, so that he doesn't have so many riches that he is trapped by those riches, but that he's also not so poor that he has to focus on, you know, having enough to eat and being tempted to do something immoral like stealing to get enough food. He wants to just have enough from God that he can focus on serving God. And that's what Agar asked for, asking these two wishes from God, what he asked for God. We could basically say that his two requests are boiled down to help me live honestly and simply so I can serve you better. And that's certainly a noble set of requests that he asked there. And I think that, you know, that's something that as we think about how we live our lives in selfie world, in the world of social media, we can very much be tempted to do exactly the opposite, to portray ourselves as something that we're not and to live a life that looks like we're living something that we're not as well. And so if we think about why we are tempted to post deceptive posts online that make us look like we have a perfect version of our lives or a perfect life, or subtly brag about it in conversation too, whether we're talking to somebody face to face, we have to realize, I think, that often what we're trying to project is a certain image of success, and that image of success is rooted in basically materialism and in pride. We want people to respect us more because we think that if they see how much stuff we have, they're going to respect us more. And it's easy to get caught up in that trap of thinking that's how the world judges success, and so that's how I judge success too. And then we often tend to post things without even really thinking about it, that's what is underlying our motive for wanting people to think and look at us in that and think that we're successful. So we want people to envy us, and by doing that, we also tempt other people to sin through envy as well. When we are posting deceitful pictures of that kind of make us look like we have more than we have, the idea then is that other people look at that and are envious of our lives, and then we're tempting them to sin through envy too. And so that's just an aspect of social media I think we have to all be aware of, and I think we are all aware of that. I'm not saying anything new here, that's a problem with social media, but it's something that's easy to do in social media and something we should think about whenever we post something on social media and whenever we're talking to people as well in our everyday conversation. We need to ask God, of God, what Agar did there for more honesty and more simplicity in our lives, not for more things and to make our lives more difficult, but to make our lives so that we can focus on walking with God and honoring him. Another aspect of this is humility in our conversation. And Proverbs 12:23 says, a prudent man concealeth knowledge, but the heart of the fool proclaimeth foolishness. And Proverbs speaks a lot about the fool. You you probably all are familiar with Proverbs and how much it talks about the fool in different ways. Basically, it often kind of describes a fool as a loud and arrogant person. There's different loud, arrogant, and ignorant person. And I think that our selfie world has made a lot of people feel like they can be an expert on pretty much anything. You can go online and you can find information and about as much information as you want to on about any subject. And some people seem to think that because they have went online and watched some YouTube videos that now they're an expert on every subject that there is, and everybody needs to hear about this expertise too. And you probably all have been with maybe with people that have erred on that side where they kind of are know-it-alls and have done their research and know everything about this subject. But Proverbs, even though that seems to be a newer thing, Proverbs was very well aware of this issue as well. And the fool is often pictured as exactly that same kind of person, somebody that is kind of a know-it-all, a loud person, and somebody that is very difficult to be around. It's interesting, too, that modern studies have verified this same problem. Sociologists call it the Dunning-Kruger effect. And it basically means that the dumber you are, the more confident you are that you're not actually dumb. And so people that think that they're really pretty smart are often actually less smart than normal. And that's because they don't have very good social skills and realize that if they rate themselves by other people around them, that they're actually maybe not that smart. They usually do this study by giving a group of people a test, and then they have them do the test, and then they ask them, how well do you think you did on the test? And then they see what the rating is of the person before they see the actual score that they got. And then often that's very comparable to how well their subjective assessment is compared to how well they actually did, and people that often rate themselves as doing very well but do very poorly, they would say that's the Dunning-Kruger effect. So living humbly means that I don't need to give my opinion about every subject. And I think that's easy for us to do in our world today, is that we kind of think that, if somebody brings up something, we need to speak up about it, especially if we've already done some research on it. But being a person of humility, and when you think about a person that's humble, it's not the person that's always first to jump up and give their opinion about everything. They don't always have to be the explainer in the room. And sometimes it's nice to have somebody that kind of knows a lot about that. I don't want to demean people that do know a lot. But often a person that's humble is not exactly that person. They're willing to be quiet and let other people talk. And they don't always have to be the one that first jumps in when somebody asks for an opinion. I think that, as Christians, as people that value truth, we should be people that do have a good basis for what we believe, so that people ask us, why do you believe what you believe about something? We should be able to explain what it is, but that doesn't mean that we always need to explain everything. And I think that can be a temptation in our world today. It can also, has always been a temptation, but it certainly is today, maybe more than ever. Instead of being the first one to give our opinion and our explanation, we often gain a lot more just by listening to people and not trying to understand what the other person is saying rather than trying to squash him. And maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more later on. This doesn't mean we can't be informed about subjects and try to understand the truth about things, but to keep from becoming the fool of Proverbs, I think there's several things we should strive for as Christians that practice humility. And I think one of these aspects is humility and understanding, or thinking about how we process information, because we process a lot of information with the internet. That's something that longer ago, your sources of information were much more limited than they are today. With the internet, there's this, many, many, many more sources for information that are just available to us right on our phones and on our computers and at our fingertips than ever before. And so we process a lot more information from a lot more sources than people in the past did. Proverbs 14:15 says, "The simple believeth every word, but the prudent man looketh well to his going. The fool believes every word they hear, but wise people think carefully about everything." That's what the ESV says. And I think that probably if you're on the internet, you can all relate to doing research on the internet versus talking to somebody who's experienced in a certain profession or a certain field. What if I go to buy something or research something, like say a dishwasher part or something like that, or even a dishwasher period, I can go on the internet and find all kinds of sources that tell me this dishwasher is the best and this one is the best and this is how you should install it, and find all these different guides, and I can think, well, I probably know quite a bit about it, until I go and talk to somebody who actually installs dishwashers. And then often what I find is those people, right away they'll say something that I realize, you know what, I actually don't know anything about dishwashers. They just pointed me to exactly the problem that I wasn't thinking about, because they do it every day, and they know what they're talking about because they have experience. And the chances are that the research that we do on the internet was probably compiled by somebody who doesn't know a lot more about the subject than we do, and often they're getting paid to push that product too. And so we have to be just wise as we think about researching stuff on the internet. Just because we saw it on the internet doesn't mean a whole lot, because we can always find something that supports what we want to hear on the internet. So online research is no match for experience and expertise, and I think that we need to be very aware that we can easily be led astray if our diet of information is mostly coming from online sources and especially on social media. And I think that there's a couple different ways that this comes out, unfortunately, in Christians and Mennonites too, in our circles. It seems like there's increasing rise in the belief of, or the promotion of, misinformation and conspiracy theories. And I think that's alarming, because it's conspiracy theories and misinformation are a sign that truth is being eroded and people are no longer listening to wise counsel, or people probably from that know what they're talking about. And often what they're hearing is the loudest and most sensational voices that are talking about a subject that are often the people that are pushing this kind of stuff. And so I think that there's a couple areas of this that Christians that we should be aware of. One of them is confirmation bias when you're talking or researching something on the internet. And that's talking about the tendency that we look for information that confirms what we already believe. And we accept facts that strengthen our position that we want to believe in, and we dismiss data that challenges what the things that we don't want to hear. And we're all very prone to that. We, as humans, it's kind of wired into us that when we go looking for something, the things that are going to pop out as are the things that disagree, and the things that we don't want to see are very easy to sweep aside and say, well, those things don't really matter. We're going to just ignore that. So if you're worried that you're dying or you're certain your symptoms for a disease mean nothing, you can probably find a website that will say you're either going to die from this or it doesn't mean anything. Actually, usually what I find is when you look up something medical related online, it always comes back to cancer. It seems like that's been my thing, that if you are worried about something and you look it up, it seems like it always leads down a trail and eventually says that you could die from this thing. And so if we're prone to that side of things, we may read that and say, oh no, I'm going to die from this disease. If we are pretty sure it's nothing, then we probably find things that point us in that direction as well. The word sinister means that left-handed people are evil, basically, and that's the original meaning of that. And so if we're a person that thinks that left-handed people are evil, just theoretically, I don't think there's many people that believe that, but I am right-handed, so I can, I guess, talk about that. Every person that's left-handed, if you're looking for this data and saying, I want to prove that left-handed people are evil, it's very easy for all the left-handed murderers to pop out at you and to ignore all the right-handed ones, or make exceptions for them and say, well, that in this case, the right-handed murder didn't count, but the left-handed one did. And then those things pop out at you. You see that somebody got murdered in the news, and you wonder, well, were they left-handed or right-handed? Not that that's usually known, but theoretically, if we see that, we'll wonder then and look for that. And then if it was a left-handed person, we'll say, well, that definitely supports the idea that left-handed people are evil. Another example of that, if you say, heard that people in a certain city like Boston are bad drivers, that they're the worst drivers. If you drive in Boston, you're probably going to be looking for that and saying, these are really bad drivers. Because every bad driver that you see is going to support your theory that Boston drivers are bad. And I think actually they, one of the big insurance companies did some kind of an accident report, and I think Houston was actually the worst city for bad drivers or accidents, but Boston was fifth in that. So it is pretty bad, but again, that's confirmation bias when we go somewhere or we see something and we think we're already looking for that information, that's the kind of information that's going to pop out at us. So just because a source says something that I believe does not make it true, and we need to be very aware of that as we're looking for information and searching for truth. Another aspect of this is conspiracy theories, and conspiracy theories don't line up with Christian values on humility and truth. They instill fear and they thrive on fear at their root. And often what's behind the idea of a conspiracy is there's some large group of kind of unknown people or hidden people that have a certain agenda and they're controlling the population through whatever it is. That's basically the root of most conspiracies. And you'll rarely find that a political conservative person will believe that conspiracies are done by Republicans, and you probably won't find a Democrat that thinks that conspiracy theories are done by Democrats. And it's a little suspicious that people seem to always lump conspiracy theories into the people they don't like. If you don't like liberals or if you don't like conservatives, they're always the instigator of the conspiracy theory. And that on its own is a little questionable, but they often hold an appeal because of their promise of having hidden knowledge, that because you understand or you know this conspiracy theory, you have knowledge that other people don't have, and it kind of gives a feeling of superiority that we know more than other people do. And so I think there's an aspect of pride that goes along with it too that's appealing to us as humans. That I hold information that what they call the sheeple, often the people, the masses, you know, don't know about this, but I have this secret information. I remember quite many years ago, I was in with, we went to Jerusalem or to Israel with a group of five of us guys when we were younger, about 19 or 20, and we stayed at a hostel in Jerusalem that Mark Twain actually, I think, stayed there when he went through. And I don't think they updated it since. It's I think it cost $15 a night. And there was an interesting crew of people that were staying there. And I remember we were sitting around in this hostel one evening and talking with some of these guys from different parts of the world and stuff. And the one guy was saying that under the Vatican City, the Catholics control the world. And under the Vatican City, there's all these catacombs with all kinds of information and gold stored in them and things. And the other guy that was sitting there, he said, yeah, I heard that too. And the other guy was surprised. He said, well, how did you know about that? And I had to think, you know, how ridiculous it was that these two people in Jerusalem who basically knew nothing about this, both thought that they had secret information about this, about the Catholic Church. You know, how unlikely is that? But they both believed that they knew something about this that probably was not true, or very little proof that it would have been. The other problem with conspiracy theories is that they often operate on slander. They ascribe evil intentions without proof or evidence of these things. They're often just said that somebody is planning to do this and they have evil intentions, and there's really no proof given to support that. And so it is a form of slander. If we're going to say something evil about something or something that puts an immoral or a bad light on somebody, we better have very good proof that that's true before we say that or charge somebody with it. That word slander comes through a lot in the New Testament. So I think that's an aspect that we need to be aware of as we think about being people of humility, people that value truth. Conspiracy theories often operate on the premise that no evidence is further proof of the conspiracy, because it's been covered up so well that, you know, if there's no evidence, that actually proves it even more. And it's almost impossible to disprove conspiracy theories, and it's not consistent with a Christian value of truth. And so I think that as Christians, we should be people that stay away from conspiracy theories, and Paul even talks about that, where he talks about old wives' fables and not getting involved in that. We should be people that are people that are, when we say something, people can believe it's the truth and not some crazy theory about something. Another aspect of humility is humility in counsel, thinking about where we get our knowledge from. And Proverbs says, a wise man will hear and will increase learning, and a man of understanding shall attain unto wise counsels. That's in the first seven verses there in Proverbs. And we, for good reasons, have become skeptical of the official sources. The officials and the experts have not been right and have made a lot of mistakes. And so sometimes we can tend to discount everything that somebody says if they're official or professional. But then I think too often what happens on the other side is then we tend to accept anything that comes from the other side. And so we can be skewed one way or the other way. Believing everything an expert says about something is not wise, and neither is believing everything that somebody who's not an expert or who says the opposite of what the expert says is wise either. But if we do a lot of our research online and think that we know a lot of stuff, we can often be led astray or led down paths that take us in the path of misinformation. We no longer are all processing the same information like people did years ago. You know, before the internet and before social media especially, information kind of came at people somewhat equally. People were kind of all looking, if you were in the same area, you kind of viewed the same sources of information. And so if you were in the area, you probably, the newspaper was probably where you got a lot of your information from, or your local radio, or if people had TV, they probably watched a lot of the same news. And if you went to the library to research something, you probably checked out the same books that other people checked out as well. And so, also you were probably more likely to talk to somebody from your church, talk to them face to face about something if you had a question about it. Now it's so easy to just go on the internet, not bother somebody else and just go on the internet and find information about just about anything. But, you know, if you get your news from social media or online, a lot of that news is just feeding you what you want to see. The Facebook will, if you start clicking on right-wing stuff, you'll get more and more right-wing stuff. If you click on left-wing stuff, you'll get fed a whole bunch on that side. And soon people are seeing two extreme sides of positions, and there's no doubt that's what's leading to a lot of the intense polarization that we have today in America in the political system, where people almost view the other side as not even human, or the people that, you know, they just can't understand them in any way because they're seeing this extreme side and the other side is seeing this extreme side, and it's definitely having a lot of harmful effects to our society. And I think that especially for maybe people that grew up before social media, it's very easy to have a more trusting view of what news is. And, you know, I know of a relative that was told my dad that all the hurricanes that were caused this last year, they were all created by the government. They're causing them to happen down in the Gulf of Mexico. And I think my dad asked him, well, why would they do that? And he wasn't really sure, but he knew that they were all being created by the government, and somehow they were controlling them because he saw it on the internet. And, you know, that's not like older people or people that grew up before social media aren't intelligent. They're often have a lot of wisdom that we as younger people may not have. But I think that we have to be very aware that anything that we see online, we have to be very, very skeptical of it, especially if it sounds skeptical or suspicious. I think that we're also a lot less likely to get other people's opinions in our churches, in our communities now, because of how easy it is to gather information that gives us a feeling, you know, that we can get anything that we want to on the internet. There's some verses in Romans 12:3 through 5 that I think are valuable in thinking about this, and maybe I'll turn to those. Romans 12:3 through 5. For I say through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we being many are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. And again, those verses speak about the value of a church community working together and the value that that is in processing information and keeping ourselves from getting led astray. And there was an article, I think, from Anabaptist Perspectives or Viewpoints. They had released one talking about misinformation. And one of the things they mentioned there was how maybe today more than ever we need the assembly or the church service where we sit and listen to one person speak, because they were saying, I think a quote from that, they said, "We live in a noisy world, and it is essential that we periodically sit and listen without opportunity to respond or disagree." And again, I don't want to stand up here and act like you're all supposed to just be listening to me because I'm up here. But I think I agree with that point, that for me to be sitting in the audience and listening to somebody is good. Where there's no opportunity for dialogue, it's just we get a chance to sit there and process what one person is feeding us rather than this conglomeration of people speaking to us like we hear throughout the day often. And I think that's, again, just reinforces the value of us meeting together physically and locally. Remote church might have its place for a few weeks or a month or two, but it's certainly not the ideal, and it can never replace the assembly of saints worshiping together. It also lets us just sit for a while and be quiet, which often is a challenge in our lives. I'm sure we all try to make time to be quiet and have our quiet time and our time of devotions, but again, the church service gives us a time where we can do that for a while and just sit and listen. So again, there may be people that we disagree with in church, and I'm sure there's people that rub us the wrong way in our churches sometimes as well, but being forced to deal with that and work together in a body is the way that we grow stronger as a church and as Christians and people that are humble and willing to work together. Another aspect here in wrapping up here is humility and listening. The word forbearance is what came to my mind as I thought about this. And, you know, today's culture is kind of a culture of outrage where there's always people talks about people, you know, you look at headlines, it says somebody slams somebody else, somebody rips, shreds, schools, blows up. You know, you see that in these headlines on clickbait on the internet, and they're often, that's how they're phrased. If you often read what was actually said, you find out that they said something very mild, but the headline says that they shredded somebody to pieces or something like that. Often it's just to get you to click on it, the clickbait. But that's kind of the world we live in, that there's just a lot of outrage and people get angry about things and get fired up because they hear that this side did this or this side did this. And, some of the people that get the most publicity are the people that just talk the loudest and the nastiest about each other. And we can easily get sucked into that whole thing of, you know, outrage, and we read something and, you know, how could they do this, and how could they stand for this, and how could somebody believe that? And it's very easy to get sucked up into that. And I think at the root of a lot of that is pride, that we think that, you know, we have a lot of insecurities, and so we think that if we can destroy the other person, somehow that makes us better than them. And that's often what outrage is kind of based on, is somebody else destroying the other person or defeating them in an argument. But whenever we defeat somebody in an argument as a Christian, I think we pretty much lost the war. We might have won that battle, but with that person, we lost out. Somebody that you got pinned down and verbally and really told them how it is, is somebody that probably is not going to be your friend the next time they see you, and probably you've lost any more chances to speak into their lives, and good chance they're just as firm in their belief as they were before, even if they got out-argued by you or me. And that's another sign of a narcissist, like we talk about. They see criticism as a personal attack on themselves, and it has to be met with a counterattack. And so I think that's what we see in our world today, is people that, you know, have very low self-esteem maybe, but they attack each other, and if somebody attacks them, they need to fight back with something bigger, and it just goes on and on. In 2 Samuel 16, 9 to 13, there's a story about David where he was being pursued by a man that was throwing rocks at him. Maybe I'll just turn there. It's in 2 Kings. It's kind of an interesting little story in 2 Samuel 6, 19. Just to give the setting there and how David responded to that. it's interesting to read that. Then said Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, unto the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take off his head." So what was happening here, this man was following David along the side of the hill and throwing rocks at him and cursing him. And says he cast stones at David and at all the servants of King David, and was also cursing at him as he went. And so he was being pretty annoying. I mean, that would be pretty annoying if somebody was following you along a road, throwing stones at you and cursing at you. And finally, the one soldier there said, "Why don't I go take care of this guy? I'll take his head." And so the king David said, "What have I done with you, ye sons of Zeruiah? Let him curse, because the Lord hath said unto him, Curse David. Who shall then say, Wherefore hast thou done so?" And David said to Abishai and all his servants, "Behold, my son, which came forth of my bowels, seeketh my life. How much more now may this Benjamite do it? Let him alone, let him curse, for the Lord hath bidden him." And so what David was doing here is he was letting himself be criticized and cursed at, because he said that criticism may be coming from God. And so I should be thinking about why this person is criticizing me and why he's saying something that's pretty outrageous about me, because maybe God is trying to speak to me through that. And so he wouldn't let the soldier there take off his head or stop him. And I think it says that he continued on. And as David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along the hillside over against him and cursed as he went and threw stones at him and cast dust. And David just went on his way while he did that. That's an example of somebody who's very humble and who's willing to put up with having their own, being annoyed and having somebody curse and yell at him and say, well, maybe they have a point and I should listen to that. There's a story that happened. The owner of Chick-fil-A, name is Dan Cathy, probably some of you have heard of him. He's, of course, a pretty famous person by now because of Chick-fil-A and how popular those restaurants are. But there's always been a lot of tension between them and the gay community because he believes in Christian marriage, one man and one woman. And so Chick-fil-A is often accused of being homophobic and things like that. And there's been a lot of protests and things against Chick-fil-A because he believes that. And there was a group, an activist named Sean Windmeyer. He was an activist for an LGBT community, Campus Pride. And they were one of the big organizers of protests against Chick-fil-A back a number of years ago. And Dan Cathy went, I guess he was trying to decide what he should do about this. Of course, he wasn't necessarily trying to stir up this tension or be hateful towards gay people, but he finally decided that what he was going to do was call him up and have a conversation with this man. And so he ended up calling his name was Shane. He called him up and they had a conversation, and then they met together and had a face-to-face conversation, and they both said what they believe. Neither of them changed their beliefs, but they both were able to have a dialogue between each other. And actually it says that they led to a friendship, and I think it was in 2012, Dan Cathy invited him to be his personal guest at the Chick-fil-A Bowl on New Year's Eve 2012. And so they were seen together, and both of them received quite a bit of criticism for that. But because of that, they both, Chick-fil-A says, pledged to avoid contributing to some organizations, and Campus Pride suspended its campaign against Chick-fil-A. And again, neither of them changed their beliefs, but they were able to sit down and listen to each other, and Dan Cathy was the one that instigated that. And I think that's a good example, not an easy thing to do, but you know, he could have entrenched and said, well, this man is a sinner, he's evil, I'm not going to listen to anything he says, and you know, just went on that path. But instead, he was the one that took the first step in reaching out to him. And I think that as Christians is our goal as well, is that we should be the instigators for the people that reach out to the other side, even if they're being hateful to us. It's just a much more Christ-like and humble way to deal with outrage versus what we see so much in our world today. And forbearance, it's kind of an old word. We don't really use the word forbearance that much anymore, but it's in the Bible. And it basically means to bear other people's weight out of our own love. And I think that's a very good way to think about how we as Christians who are humble should live in a world of outrage in our selfie world today. Paul in Romans 15:1 says that we have an obligation to bear with the failings of the weak. And that's a challenge for us as Christians to live like Christ did and to be able to do that. But when we're willing to be people that listen instead of yell louder than the other side, I think that has a really powerful witness to the world and especially to the people that we're reaching out to. So that would be a challenge, I think, too, as we think about being people of humility, is that we don't let social media lure us into these outrage, these debates and things on social media that in the end, all they basically do is get Facebook more clicks anyway. I don't think anybody's minds get changed, but it's very easy to get drawn into those fights. And that can happen very well in our personal conversation as well. It's not just something that happens online. So I think that if we can be people that can let go of our pride and our prejudice, and we should be able to be people as Christians, people that can converse with people that are rich or poor, liberals or conservatives, and whatever side people are on, if we're Christ followers, we should be people that people don't see as the enemy necessarily. They may not agree with us, but I think that as humble people, they'll have a hard time hating us. And again, maybe some people still will, but as people that are willing to be humble and listen to the other side and not be people that are spreading outrage, I think that'll be a powerful testimony for us as Christians. And so, in summary, I think that humility, you know, it's not about losing. It's not about being weak or being a coward. That's how some people portray humility, that, you know, it's just the person who's weak. But that's not what humility is. And I think that's kind of a lie of our culture that fueled so much by outrage, is that meekness and humility are inferior to yelling louder and so much of what we see out there today. In contrast to that, you can see how Paul talks about humble love that's submitted to the kingdom, and it's just an incredibly powerful witness to the world when they see that. And I think that, you know, when we think about how we can be people that are humble in a selfie world, there's a lot of Christians out there that are doing that too. And so I don't want to just be negative about this and say that everything that is online is bad or negative. There's a lot of Christians that are posting a lot of good stuff online, that have good blog posts, good Facebook posts, whatever. And you can see that if you are on social media. There's certainly a lot of good stuff out there as well. And so I think that we as Christians should be people that model humility in our life, whether it's online or offline. And when we can model that behavior and show people humility, I think that will really stand out in a selfie world that we're living in today. So these thoughts, why don't we bow our heads for a word of prayer. Dear God, we come before you this evening and we're grateful for your many blessings to us. Thank you for bringing us safely here this evening, and we just ask that you would be with each of us as we think about living in our world today, a world that is filled with pride and self-absorption. And we just pray that you would help us to be Christians that stand out for our humility and for our love to other people, and that is what people could see when they meet us, either online or in our everyday lives. We pray that you would just help us and that your Spirit would direct us as we live that out. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Turn the time over.